battle just seems to be raging so much stronger, so much louder. And I was in a conversation this week, and this is a conversation that seems like comes up a lot, but it seems like our world has just gotten stuck in fear. I was watching a commercial, and there's a get out and get vaccinated commercial, and they were showing it. It's a little boy throwing an airplane, and the song that's going in the background is "The World's Gone Crazy." I heard, you know, just heard that phrase in the song, and so there's just all this stuff coming at us. And as I was in this conversation about fear, one of the things that just has come into my thinking and into my spirit is that we really, the fear isn't over vaccination, not vaccination, or COVID or not COVID. I think what we're really afraid of, if we really boil it down, is we're afraid of losing control. And I think that we have the world sort of is able to survive and go on because they have this sort of pseudo-control. And we think that we can control our futures, we can control our destinies, we can control what we do today to day. And all of a sudden, we hit something like this virus thing, and it totally puts us out of control. There is no control. You can mask up, you can vaccinate, you can quarantine, you can stay safe. And you know what? You can still get this thing. And it can still put you in a hospital. It can still kill you. And all of a sudden, our world has gone out of control. And just realize that the control we thought we had is a mist. It really isn't real. And what happens then is when we come out of control, we then begin to be driven by fear. And then what happens on top of that is we try to regain control. Well, get vaccinated, you can control it. You know, mandate vaccines, government can control it. You know, and all of a sudden, we start grabbing for control wherever we can just to bring order back into our lives. The cool thing is for me, I understand I am out of control, that I can't do a thing, and there's only one person who control anything, and that is Jesus and God. That's it. And I put my trust in Him. That's where I, in this battle, if you will. So as a country, as a human race right now, we are in the battle of a lifetime, but let's not get confused over the battle. The battle isn't about a virus. The battle isn't about, you know, the onslaught of things happening in our culture and political correctness and cancel culture and all that stuff. That's not where the battle is. The battle has been raging since before the dawn of man. And the Bible tells us that battle is between good and evil, God and Satan and his forces. And the Bible tells us that that battle is going to go on all the way in Revelation to the end of time, to the end of Satan's time anyway. And here's the deal. We did not choose this battle. We didn't choose it, but we've been chosen for it. We didn't choose this battle, but we've been chosen for it. So what do we do? How do we wage war in this world? How do we have the courage of a David in the face of a Goliath? Last week, we began to wade into this epic battle in the Old Testament. I think it's one of the best battles in the Old Testament. It's definitely one of the biggest underdog stories that you could ever run into. Little David versus this huge Goliath. To set that all up, you can go back to last Sunday's sermon. Sorry, we're still having some tech difficulty for you that are online. But you can go on to our podcast on our webpage. YouTube got the whole thing minus about 30 seconds. So you can go back to those two places, hear the whole background. But just to bring us up to speed really quick with a couple highlights. You have the nation of Israel. They now have established themselves after coming back from Egypt, and they start whining for a king. God tells them, you don't want this because this king is going to take you over. This king is going to steal your stuff. He's going to take your kids and list them into his armies to fight his wars. You don't want a king. They keep crying, everybody else has a king. And so God says, okay, fine, you can have a king. And so they get a king, and he's actually a good king to start with, King Saul. He's a handsome man. He stands a head and shoulder above everybody else, and everything goes well. Samuel said, you know, this is the way this is going to work. God's still in charge. I'm going to speak for God. I'm going to talk with you, and here's what you're going to do. Here's what God does. And things went well until things started going to Saul's head. And then Saul started to get a big head about himself. He started to take liberties that he was never entitled to take. And eventually he steps over a couple lines, and God's wrath comes against him. And God says, okay, you know, my blessing is off of you because you're not listening to me anymore. And then he tells Samuel, you need to go out and find the next king that I've already chosen. And Samuel goes out in this hunt, and he finds this little shepherd boy named David in Jesse's family, and he anoints him as the next king of Israel. So the blessing is off to Saul, but Saul is still at this point running the kingdom. And Saul starts getting himself in trouble. He starts picking wars he shouldn't pick. He starts doing things that he shouldn't do. And eventually, the Philistines, which you have to understand, the nation of Israel, it sets sort of along the Sea of Galilee, but this whole region up here. So let me sort of picture this. You have the Sea of Galilee, and then you have Israel. This whole section is controlled by Philistines and the Philistines. And so Saul's picking all these armies and wars and whatnot, and the Philistines finally have enough, and they're like, this is just a scrawny little would-be nation. We're going to wipe them out. And so the Philistines pick up arms, and they come to fight Israel and just wipe them out, make them their slaves. So they end up invading the northwest sort of area of Israel, and they begin to draw up some battle lines, and they're about ready to have a war. So I got a picture this week. It's a map. Here's the valley. And so the Sea of Galilee is off to our left a ways, quite a ways, about 30 miles or so. But this valley's running through here. So Israel's coming up this side, and the Philistines are coming up this side, and they're drawing up their battle lines right where that brown field is. That is where David fought Goliath, right there. It still exists, still in place in Israel today. So the Philistines draw up their battle lines. The army's about to happen. The Israelites come down, and they draw up their battle lines in those hills, and they're going to have this war down in the battle, or this battle down in the valley. And then this huge giant comes out, and he challenges the nation of Israel and says, why kill everybody? Why have a bloodbath here? You pick your best guy. I'm our best guy. Let's have a fight to the end, see who wins, and whoever wins takes over the other nation. We'll just do it more peacefully that way. So this is where we left off last week. The battle lines have been drawn. The warriors have been called out, and there's a lot on the line in this battle. And the reality is that's where we're at today. The battle lines have been drawn. We're in the war. The war's going on. The warriors, we have been called out. That's why we end up in the battle, why we get picked on every now and then, more now than then, I think. And there's a lot riding on the line of this. We can't just turn a blind eye. There's a lot on the line with this. Now we're going to jump back into 1 Samuel 17. So if you have your Bible, you can just follow right along. We're going to literally walk through the scripture this morning. We're going to put it on the overhead as well. And I'm just going to pull out some things as we're going along here. So we're going to start with verse 4. We've sort of wrapped up the first couple of verses last week. But verse 4, a champion named Goliath, who was from Gath, came out to the Philistine camp. His height was 6 cubits and a span. Now, no matter how you figure it up, Goliath was a big guy. In fact, we use the word Goliath to talk about big things. You know, that's a Goliath of a problem, or that's a Goliath of a person. And it represents, even in our culture, a big problem or a big man. Now, the scriptures tell us that he was 6 cubits and a half tall. More ancient manuscripts recorded as 4 cubits and a half tall, and that causes a little bit of confusion how tall he was. When we were down to the ark, I got a cubit. This is supposedly a cubit, okay? But a cubit, here's what, a cubit is an imprecise measurement. A cubit is the forearm. So this from here to here, and this is another place they can't figure out. Sometimes a cubit was from here to the wrist, and sometimes a cubit was here to the fingertips. So that's a problem. We don't know which was which when they were measuring what in the scriptures. Another issue is some of you have a larger cubit than I have as a cubit. So if you're a smaller person, you have a smaller cubit. If you're a big person, you have a bigger cubit. So a cubit could range anywhere from 16 to 22, 23 inches tall. And so what we know of this is that the size of this giant was somewhere between 7.5, 8 foot tall up to 11 foot tall. Now remember, King Saul was an unusually tall guy himself for the times, and Goliath would have towered over him. Shaquille O'Neal, by the way, is 7 foot 1 inches tall. Okay, just gives you perspective. Andre the Giant. You guys remember, you might be too young to remember Andre the Giant. Remember Andre the Giant? Okay. Andre the Giant was 7'4" and the tallest man recorded in the Guinness Book of World Records, Robert Willow, was measured at 8'11". So these guys were actually shorter than Goliath. Follow me, camera. We're going to do a lesson. As you're coming in and out this morning, I want you to picture this because you need to understand this. So on the back wall, I put it where y'all have to walk through it. Okay, yep, you can turn around, scooch around. If Goliath was on the short end, he was this tall. That's 8 foot, okay? That's still a really big person. That's this much taller than me. That would have been his head, okay? On the tall end, he would have been 11 foot tall. Could you imagine running into this guy? I'd be a little scared. Hi, did you see that on the camera? Sorry, it's hard to tell, but that's big. No, right? So no matter how you cut this, this guy was huge. He was a Goliath. let's look at scripture a little further. He had a bronze helmet on his head. He wore a coat of scale armor of bronze weighing 5,000 shekels. On his legs, he wore bronze greaves, and a bronze javelin was slung on his back. His spear shaft was like a weaver's rod. Its iron point weighed 600 shekels. His shield bearer went ahead of him. Now, he wasn't just tall. This guy was... He had well over 150 pounds strapped on him when he was walking around. I was going to ask who weighs 150 pounds, and Eric, you weigh 150 pounds? Jump on Lauren's back and see how well she can do. 150 pounds. And it isn't just like, oh, he's a warrior, which means he's carrying that stuff like this. No big deal. Not a problem at all. This guy was huge. He was tall, but he was also stout. I mean, he was muscular. He was built. Goliath was so big that he had to have this special suit of armor made for him. Now, shekels, another complication with measurements. Shekels were used as weight, sort of like an English pound. It was used as a weight, but is also used as a price tag. So a shekel could go either way. It's referring to a price or it's referring to a weight. And when it's talking about his armor here, it's probably referring to both. That his armor wasn't just heavy, it was expensive. This is a lot of bronze going on here, a lot of craftsmanship. This was not a suit of armor that, when this battle's over, we'll throw it aside and we'll grab some new. You know, no, this stuff got passed on. It went on to other families. It was in itself, the armor was a small fortune. That, by the way, is really important for next Sunday's sermon when we see what happens with the victor, okay? But it was not just heavy, but it was expensive as well. So here comes this Goliath marching down into the field. Now, another thing I learned this week that I found was fascinating with all of this. Scholars believe that Goliath was actually the descendant from a race of people called the Anakim. A-N-A-K-I-M. Anakim or Anakim. Now, I don't know if the Bible, I don't think the Bible has coincidence. I just don't think that happens in the scriptures. But the Israelites have actually ran into this race of people before. And let me just jog your mind a little bit. When they were coming back from Egypt to take the promised land, Moses chose 12 spies. Remember this story? And they sent them over in the promised land to check it all out. Two spies, you remember their names? Joshua and Caleb. They came back and they're like, we can do it. You know, this is the land's full of milk and honey. It's awesome. It's so luscious. We can do it. But 10 of the spies came back and they said, there is a race of people there, the Anakim, who are warriors and they're giants. They're giant warriors. And we can't do this. We can't take it. And their bad report then spoiled or went through the ears like gossip of all the Israelites, spoiled and just downtrodden all the Israelites. They began to, woe is us. We come out here just to have God destroy us by these people that own our land. And they start whining. And God says, okay, if you won't trust me more than this, then you're going to wander in the wilderness for 40 years. And basically, one whole generation dies in the wilderness. And then their kids are the ones who take on the Anakim. Now, isn't this fascinating? 400 years later, so that battle or that going over into Israel and checking it all out with the spies, that happened at about 1440 BC. It was in 1440 BC. 400 years later in Israel's history now, in around 1040 BC, about 400 years later, here they are again facing the same people, facing this giant from this race called the Anakim. And here we are again with the Israelites cowering in fear, running with their tail between their legs from the same group of people. And I think the same question is being asked of the Israelites. Do you trust me more than the giants that you see in front of you? And I would propose to you, when we're facing spiritual battles, the same question is being asked of us. Do you trust me, God is asking, more than you trust the giant that you see in front of you? Who do you trust? Goliath stood and he shouted to the ranks of Israel, why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine? Are you not the servants of Saul? Choose a man and have him come down to me. If he's able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects. But if I overcome him and kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us. And then the Philistine said, this day I defy the armies of Israel. Give me a man. Let us fight each other. And on hearing the Philistine's words, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. Does that not sound like a flashback to 400 years earlier, when those 10 spies came back and, oh, we'll never be able to beat them? What is worse in this situation is that this giant is not just defying the armies of Israel, but they're defying the God. He's defying the God of Israel as well. I think that's sort of good news and bad news. It's good news for, I think, the armies of Israel because he's bringing God into this battle. I think it's bad news for the Philistines because they don't know what they're doing picking on God. God's a little bigger than just a big giant. But still, King Saul cowers. And all the army cowers. Their spirits fall. And when the challenge is made, they just sort of walk away all sad. And I think the same question's being asked of us 3,000 some years later. Do you trust me more than the giant that's right in front of you? Do you really trust me? Let's go on into this battle. Read some more of this story. For 40 days, the Philistines came forward every morning and evening and took his stand. So I'm just going to give you some points as we go along here. So number two, the enemy is very persistent. The enemy is very persistent. One of the first things that jumped out at me from this story was that this enemy just kept coming back morning and evening for 40 days over and over and over, you know, just taunting and taunting and taunting. And I think, I wish that the enemy would ever attack us or only attack us maybe once a week. Wouldn't that be nice? Or every other week or maybe once a year. All right, we beat them. We don't have to deal with this again. Every day, morning and night, this attack came. The enemy is very persistent. Let's jump into a big section of scripture there. This is going to move a lot. Verse 17. Now Jesse said to his son David, take the ephah of roasted grain and these 10 loaves of bread for your brothers, and hurry to the camp. Take along these 10 cheeses to the commander of their unit. See how your brothers and me bring back, or see how your brothers are, and bring back some assurance from them. They are with Saul and all the men of Israel in the valley of Elah, fighting against the Philistines. Early in the morning, David left the flock in care of the shepherd, loaded up and set out. as Jesse had directed. He reached the camp as the army was going out to battle positions, shouting the war cry. Israel and the Philistines were drawn up their lines, facing each other. David left his things with the keeper of supplies, ran to the battle lines, and asked his brothers how they were. As he was talking with them, Goliath, the Philistine champion from Gath, stepped out from the battle lines and shouted his usual defiance, and David heard it. Whenever the Israelites saw the man, they fled from him in great fear. Now the Israelites had been saying, "Do you see this? How this man keeps coming out? He comes out to defy Israel. The king will give great wealth to the man who kills him. He will also give his daughter in marriage and will exempt his family from taxes in Israel." Yeah! Be awesome if my kids did that. Exempt us all! Woo! And they repeated to him what they had been saying and told him, "This is what will be done for the man who kills him." When Eliab, David's oldest brother, heard him speaking with them, he burned with anger and asked, "Why have you come down here? And with whom did you leave those few sheep in the wilderness? I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You came down here only to watch the battle." "And what have I done?" said David. "Can't I even speak?" And I love it. He then turned away to somebody else, and he brought up the matter, and the men answered him as before. Make a couple points out of here. And here's the big point. I don't know, I wonder why verse 28 in here, when Eliab, David's oldest brother, heard him, I'm not quite sure why that's even in there. It doesn't add a whole lot to the story. And so if it's in there, it's in there for a reason. And as I was just processing that and thinking about that, here's what hit me. We got to be careful of we have to be careful of friendly fire. We're in a battle against an enemy. And David's not getting fire from the enemy. He's getting friendly fire from his own brother. So, two sides of this. One, receiving friendly fire. First, we have to realize that when we make a decision to wade into the battle, there are going to be some people in the church, and there are going to be some Christian people that ain't going to like what you're doing. And they're going to think, "Man, you know, that's just dumb. Don't do that, you know, or why are you picking on that battle? Or why are you shooting your mouth off there? That's not the way we've ever done that before, Pastor." You know, those things will come up, and we will get attacked by friendly fire from people that should be with us and going with us and supporting us. And this is what happened with David. He got friendly fire from his own brother. Now, I think Eliab was frankly embarrassed, because here's his little snot-nosed brother coming to the battle, and he's just cowering in fear. No older brother wants to be seen that way. So I think he was embarrassed. And he turned his embarrassment into anger and then started to yell at him. But here's the second side. We have to be careful of giving friendly fire. Here's just a reality. When we come under attack, there is a huge potential to start taking out our frustrations on whatever that attack is. Maybe it's from work. Maybe you got a bad report. You know, I don't know what it could be. There's thousands of things that it could be. But when we get in these attacks, we have a propensity to take it out on the people that we love the most when they had nothing to do with it. And we need to be careful of that. Because when we're under that stress and we're under that strain, it's really easy to just start lashing out on the people that we really are protecting and loving the most. So we need to be careful of giving friendly fire. And boy, Eliab should have been a little more careful, but instead he just let it fly with David there. Okay, verse 31. What David said was overheard and reported to Saul, and Saul sent for him. And David said to Saul, "Let no one lose heart on account of this Philistine. Your servant will go and fight him." And Saul replied, "You're not able to go out against this Philistine and fight him. You're only a young man, and he has been a warrior from his youth." Little point here. Don't be discouraged by the naysayers. You know, anytime we want to do something great, there's going to be somebody that's going to, "Oh, I don't know. I don't think you're good enough, big enough, smart enough, rich enough, blah, 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 blah." There's always going to be naysayers. And I tell you, I see it around the church too. You know, somebody comes to me and they're like, "I have this great idea." And I'm like, "Awesome." One of my things is, if God gave you a great idea, he probably wants you to do that great idea, not me, okay? And I'll support you. But one of the things that people run into is, then there'll be other people like, "Oh, I don't know, you should do that." I don't know if that's a great thing to do. Don't be discouraged by the naysayers. David threw that off. But David said to Saul, listen to what he said. Your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and carried off the sheep from the flock, I went after it, struck it, and rescued the sheep from its mouth. When it turned on me, I seized it by the hair, struck it, and killed it. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, because he has defied the armies of the living God. The Lord who rescued me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will rescue me from the hand of this Philistine. Saul said to David, go, and the Lord be with you. Here's my point for here. You've been prepared, now believe in yourself. You've been prepared, believe in yourself. David didn't just come raw to this thing. God had been already working in David's life. God had already showed up in his life to show him how he could deal with a lion and deal with a bear. And I'm sure the first time he ran into this, he was probably a little scared. But God showed up, and God showed him how to use that sling. God showed him how to... Can you imagine taking a bear or a lion? We're not talking a zoo bear. Okay? Could you imagine taking a bear and going... And I would. Okay? I've seen some bears. And even those cute, cuddly little brown bears get to be really big, okay? And he said, I took it by the hair and I threw it down. David had been trained for this by God, and so David wasn't put off. He had been prepared. He knew what he could do, and he needed to believe in that. Now, we need to believe in ourselves. Now, this is not some pop psychology, so don't go, oh, pop psychology, God, believe it. That is a mantra of our day and our culture. Believe, just believe in yourself. No, you need to believe in yourself because of what God has already done inside of you. That's why we can have any belief in ourselves. Is because God's already shown up. Now, this year, we started doing something. We're collecting them on the back wall back there. LifeSpring stories, yellow cards and blue cards. They're still floating around. I'm still seeing a few more pop up every now and then. I want you to keep writing those stories. We're going to be doing this all year until December, and then I'd like to pull them all together and put them in a little booklet or something. But we're collecting stories where we're seeing God working in our lives. Either God did something for us, or God invited us into his story to do something for somebody else. We're still collecting those stories. Why? Because that is God's way that he has been preparing us for this very moment. And we need to remember those things. So what David did here, he looked over his shoulder and said, you know what? I remember what God did back there. I remember what God did in the wilderness with the lion. I remember what God did with the bear back there and how he helped me with that. This giant is no more than a bear, a lion. With God on my side, no problem. We can take him. Verse 38. Then Saul dressed David in his own tunic. He put a coat of armor on him and a bronze helmet on his head. David fastened on his sword over the tunic and tried to walk around because he was not used to them. How tall was Saul? Head and a shoulder taller than everybody else. Is David an adult here? He's a kid. Now, could you imagine Saul's armor on David? It's just sort of dumb just thinking about it. You know, this ain't going to work. And David says, I can't go in these, he said to Saul, because I'm not used to them. So he took them off. Then he took out his staff. He took his staff in his hand, chose 5 smooth stones from the stream, put them in his pouch of the shepherd's bag, and with his sling on his hand, approached the Philistine. Have you ever played the if-only game in your life? The if-only game? Come on, anybody play that? If-only? If only I had this, if only I had that, if only I lived in this house, if only I had this husband or this wife, if only I had, you know, this family that I was born to, if only I had da-da-da-da, if I had that car, if I had this job, if I had this church, if only we had this song that we would sing on a Sunday morning, you know, if only, if only, if only, if only. And this is what's happening here, is Saul, and isn't this ironic, the guy who is afraid to go fight the giant tries to put an if only on this little kid David. If only you do it my way, Saul's saying, if you put on my army, then okay, you might stand a chance here, okay? If only. And sometimes we can get caught up in this if only game. And I also wanted to label this point, maybe this one. Don't fight in someone else's armor. That's the if only. If only I was facing their battle, it wouldn't be so bad. You know, if only I had their gifts and their talents and whatnot, then I could do this. You know, don't get involved, don't get defeated by the if only game. As I just said, you've been prepared for this battle at hand, and you need to wage in and fight and stop playing the if only game. Don't play it. If only we went to this seminar, you know, learned how to do church their way, then, you know, the church would be so much better. No, we got to let that go. God has prepared us for what we need to face. He has prepared LifeSpring Church for this moment and this time and this age for what we need to do. He has prepared you exactly the way he wanted you prepared to face what you are facing right now. Throw off the if onlys. 41. I love David's response. Meanwhile, the Philistine with his shield bearer in front of him kept coming closer to David. He looked David over and saw that he was a little more than a boy, growing with health and handsome, and he despised him. Isn't that interesting? This big monstrous giant despises this little kid. And he said to David, "Am I a dog that you've come out here with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. "Come here," he said, "and I'll give your flesh to the birds and the wild animals." I want to make a couple points here. Verses 40, 41, David and Goliath enter into this war. Goliath's like, "Oh, who's this kid you're sending to me?" You know, he starts making fun of David. "You know, you're going to come out and fight me with sticks. Don't you see my armor? Don't you see everything that I have?" And he yells out to him, "I'm going to eat you for lunch," basically. So he's barking at David, "I'm going to eat you." Now, here's my idea, my point here. Don't be scared of the enemy's bark, because the enemy can bark loud. Now, I cannot say that his bark is worse than his bite, because that's not true. If David got within arm's reach of Goliath, he would have been mincemeat, okay? He's a giant. He could have pounced on David. Just imagine, just picture this. Little David, big giant. If big giant just fell over on David, he'd wipe him out, okay? So his bark is bad, but his bite is just as bad. You know, this is scary. He's barking out at little David here. The enemy's screaming at him. And I want to remind you, the enemy's bark is loud. And it's nasty. And he screams to the top of his lungs. Unfortunately, his bite can be just as bad. And right now, we're getting a little bit of that bite and a little bit of that bark in our culture. How can you believe in this Jesus stuff? You know, how can you be so exclusive? How can you be so narrow-minded? That's a big word, narrow-minded. In our cancel culture, if you don't do well the way we think things should be, you know, we're going to cancel you. You're not going to have a Facebook channel. We're going to take you out of YouTube. On and on and on goes this stuff. We can put you out of business. We can ostracize you. We'll cut you off. The enemy's bark is loud, but frankly, in our culture, the bite is just as bad now as well. You know, so it's both bad. Our enemy is barking and he is biting. But, has to be a big but, even though his bark and his bite might be dangerous and loud, God is the ultimate authority, and the God we serve is bigger than him, and bigger than his bark, and God's bite is a whole lot worse than the devil's ever can be. And this was what boldness was filling little David. Listen to how he responded to this giant. David said to the Philistine, "You come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I'll strike you down, and I'll cut off your head. This very day I'll give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds and the wild animals, and the whole world will know there is a God in Israel. And all those gathered here will know that it is not by sword or spear that the Lord saves. For the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands." Isn't that awesome? David understood some things. David had a proper perspective of this battle. Let me give you a couple quick points. We're going to get into these. We're going to get out. We're going to go into communion. Here we go. Number one, don't be surprised. We sometimes, oh, the devil's attacking us. Why? We shouldn't be surprised over that. David knew if he went down in there that the giant was going to go after him. He wasn't surprised. Oh, I didn't think you really meant it. No, don't be surprised. Jesus even said, don't be surprised when bad things happen to you. If it happened to me, guess what? It's going to happen to you. Don't be surprised. Number 9, never forget your place in the battle. Never forget your place in the battle. You are not the warrior in this fight. I had a district superintendent back in Oakdale, back in Minnesota, and he had a bunch of pithy sayings, just like my mom. And one of his sayings was, guys, don't forget, you sometimes don't have a dog in this fight. You ever heard that? You don't have a dog in this fight. And what he meant is, don't get involved in fights that you really have no business being in because it doesn't involve you. You don't have a dog in this fight. And I sort of think that's what was going on in David's head here. The battle's been going on, and I've been chosen for this part of the battle right now. But the reality is, I don't have a dog in this fight. You picked on God. Good luck. I'm just his soldier right now. God's the one who's going to fight this thing. When we come under spiritual attack, it's very tempting to think that it's all about us. It's tempting to think that if I'm going to have a victory, then I got to try harder, I got to do better, and I got to think of what I can do. It's all about my faith and my trust. Well, it isn't. First, the battle that we've gotten sucked into, we looked at last week, has been going before you were here, and it's going to be going after you were gone. This battle's been going on for a long time in Satan's reign of terror. And one day, the devil and his demons are going to be destroyed once and for all. And God is going to win once and for all. And we're simply a little piece in this whole thing going along here. It's not all about you. I know that might be depressing. But it's not. We're just a little piece of this thing. The battle is God's. And God is going to show up, and God is going to fight. And I love it, because the Philistine picked on God, bad idea, and he's going to lose. We're going to see that, okay? Number 10, the victory is not ours. So if the battle's not ours, and we're just a piece of this thing, the victory's not ours. When we win, it's not us who won, it's who? God who won. The victory's not ours. We're going to talk a lot more about that next week as we talk about the outcome of all of this. And number 11, 8, 9, 10. Yeah, I did number those right. Number 11. Worldly tools are of little value. You come against me with sword and spear, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty. Man, when we go to that level, this stuff, physical stuff, worldly stuff, these tools, they're of no value. The media may come at you and slam you on Facebook. They may cut us out of our society in America. I don't know what all could happen to us as followers of Jesus Christ. All that stuff can come at us, but here's the reality. That's all earthly weapons. That's javelin and spears. And that's not how we come to fight, is it? We come in the name of the Lord Almighty, and who can stand up against that? Not even the devil. Not even the devil. Look at Goliath. He is armed to the teeth with what every soldier could long for. He had every piece of weaponry at his disposal. He was ready for combat. And all David brought into this was a slingshot and some stones. He didn't bring a sword. Slingshot and some stones. And on the worldly front, that looks totally ridiculous, doesn't it? It does on a worldly front. But when you look at it from a God side, he brought everything he needed. God had prepared him. God had showed him. He came very prepared. And this is an interesting sight. If the spiritual battle, bringing material goods into this battle, it's going to be of little value. David brought what he knew and what God had showed him, and he was going to win. Last week, I read to you that one third, and I just thought this was interesting, that we read in Scripture that Lucifer and one third of the angels fell from heaven or got kicked out. I wouldn't say fell. They got kicked out, okay? So they get thrown out of heaven. One third. Now, are some of you good at math? I think, Sean, you should be. It's your job. Okay. I'm going to. If one third got kicked out, how much is left? at your mind a second. If one third got kicked out, that's Lucifer and his demons, how much is left in heaven doing God's work? Two thirds, the bigger part. And those forces up in heaven, guys, sometimes I think we lift Satan and what he can do up too high. If we're going to lift Satan up and all of his attacks and all of his evil, I hear a lot of people talking about a lot of evil in our world. We lift that up. But let's look at the other side of this. If that's what Satan is doing with only one third, what could God do with two thirds? And he's the winner already and he's all powerful, you know? Two thirds are behind David ready to go to war against this Goliath. And when you start looking at it from that perspective, in that battlefield that I showed earlier, which side is really now looking like they shouldn't go down there? And it's not Goliath. Or it's not David. It's Goliath. He's going to get his hiney whipped. Let's go on verse 48. We're wrapping up this morning. As the Philistine moved closer to attack David, David ran quickly towards... I could have made another point there. David ran quickly to meet him. Didn't stand back here like... He ran out to go get him. Reaching into his bag, taking out a stone, he slung it, and he struck the Philistine on the forehead, and the stone sank into his forehead, and he fell down onto the ground. I actually have a David-like slingshot in my office. We picked it up when we were in Israel, and I don't know if you remember this, Michelle. We were, I don't know, Bethlehem or where. There was some, guy, street vendor, selling these things, and he's like putting stones in this slingshot. I could not make the thing work, okay? I couldn't do it. This guy put this stone in there. He points, wire? I'm like, yeah, I see the wires. He, boom, he hit the wire. I was like, whoa. I couldn't do that good with a gun and scope, you know? I mean, it wasn't like the wire was just right here. It was like clear at the back of the sanctuary. He's like, boom! And I was amazed. I have one of those slingshots if you want to see it. And this is exactly what David did. And the stone sank into the guy's head, and he fell to the ground. So David triumphed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone. Without a sword in his hand, he struck down the Philistine, and then he killed him. What an awesome story. As I read that, I like to think, what would it have been like to be there? Hello? What would it have been like to be in that battle at that moment and to see that giant fall and come crashing down with all of his armor, with his spears, with all of his stuff that he had on, and yet, boom, he goes to the ground, and this little boy goes running over. Could you imagine David climbing up on Goliath? I mean, if he's that big, he's got to be pretty good size. You know, climbing up on him and grabbing his sword, and whoosh, off goes his head. Wow. What a battle. I was looking for the picture. I couldn't find it, and I'd heard it several years ago, the story. A little boy was getting picked on at school. And every day he'd go to school, and the bully in the school would come and steal his milk money or his lunch money or whatever, take his lunch, take whatever he could get from him. And this went on for several weeks, and eventually the little boy came home one day and he started talking to his big brother. He started telling his big brother what was going on, and the big brother gave him some great brotherly advice. Well, the next time this happens, you go up to him and you just tell him to knock it off or I'm going to punch you. Little boy, big bully. Well, the next day comes, the little guy is a little scared about this, a little worried that this is not going to probably go well, but, you know, big brother said, this is what I need to do. And so the bully, sure enough, meets him on his way to school, wants to take his lunch money and whatnot, and is going to, you know, pick on him again. And this time, instead of just cowering and throwing it down, the little boy holds on to his stuff, walks up to him and says, you know what? If you try to do this again, I'm going to punch you. And all of a sudden, this bully backed off. And before too long, and then now you could see the welling up of the pride and the, whoa, you know, this worked. You know, the little kid's, he grows from that big to this big, and he just starts welling with courage. And yeah, I want to punch you, do this again. And eventually the bully ran off. Well, what the little brother didn't see was big brother standing behind a tree looking at the bully. Folks, that's the image of the war that we're fighting. We're that little kid. We're chasing down this bully. But we have to remember behind us is Big Brother. Well, he's my father. And he's standing there like, go ahead, bring it on. I'm ready. Oh God, you are bringing us into some battles that are pretty tough to face. And you have prepared us for this moment. But we do not wage into this war or wade into this battle alone. But you go with us. You prepared us for this moment. And I pray that we will stand tall, we will stand strong with you behind us, knowing that you got this, and knowing the end of the story that eventually we win. And so as we come to communion this morning, Father, I pray for these elements that are before us, this reminder of who you are and what you've done for us. That Jesus, you already took on the big fight and you won. You came back from the grave victorious over sin, the ultimate weapon that the devil's throwing at us. And you won. And so God, as we come into this moment this morning, as we take these elements, I just pray that you will settle upon our minds and our spirits that we are victorious. We can rise up and we can be the warriors, the men, the women that you've called us to be, not because of what we can do, but because it is you who we serve. It is you who goes around us and before us and works through us. So this morning, Father, we want to touch your throne as we remember, Jesus, what you did for us by winning the ultimate battle on a cross. Amen.